I have a son that farms with me, and he's trying to make a go of it. It's hard to get started.
Larry Tegler is a farmer in Nebraska. He grows mostly corn and soybeans. He came from a family of farmers, and after spending some time as a high school math teacher, he had an opportunity to go back to farming. So he took it. He and his son are trying the best they can to make a living as farmers. But he says increasing property taxes make it hard for small farmers like him to get by.
It's the way it is in farming. We do have good years and we have bad years. The thing about that darn property tax, though, is it doesn't change with a good year or a bad year. It's just there. And when you have those bad times, if it's $80 an acre, it's going to be $80 an acre, you know, or maybe more the next year until we see some valuation drop and they do lower the valuations on some of this land.
Larry and his son run a family farm, but it's probably not the kind of farm you're thinking of. They don't have a small red barn with a dairy cow out front, chickens running through the yard. They farm long stretches of row crops and use a fancy tractor that practically drives itself. The point being, family farms today come in nearly all shapes and sizes, and they face a pretty wide variety of challenges.
A lot of this land is farmer-owned. Some of this right around here where we're standing is investor-owned and has been for a number of years. But a lot of it's farmer-owned, and there aren't that many of us out here anymore.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll get to know the family farm and all its complexity in 2016, zooming in on those family farmers working in Kansas and Missouri. This is all against the backdrop of what some might call big ag, that is, a changing industry model with multinational corporations becoming increasingly large and powerful. I want to start by talking to Jeremy Bernfeld. He's the editor of Harvest Public Media, reporting on food and agriculture for public radio stations across the country. Harvest Public Media, as you may know, is based here at KCUR, and Jeremy's speaking with us from Cincinnati this morning. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Gina.
You alerted us to some big changes on the business side of agriculture, things that could really affect all of us, perhaps more than we realize, whether we're farmers or just consumers. What's going on with the merging of big ag companies?
Yeah, I think the story of agriculture over the last, I don't know, almost 100 years, at least since post-World War II, has been consolidation. You heard Larry Tegler there in Nebraska talk a little bit about farm consolidation. You know, there's not many of us left, is what he said. But there's also a lot of consolidation that has gone on in the, as you said, business side. Basically, to cut to the long and the short of it, five of the six largest kind of agribusiness input companies have plans to merge. And so we're talking about, for instance, Missouri-based Monsanto. Bayer, which is based in Europe, reached a deal with Monsanto to buy the company, you know, for billions of dollars. And what this means is that where there used to be thousands of companies that would sell seeds, that would sell fertilizers, that would breed hybrid crops, that number has just been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And the worry, I think, from some antitrust advocates, from some farm advocates, is that you know, you're turning the top six into three or four companies, and it's just going to kind of further go down that pipe.
I understand, kind of, but not really, that there's something to do with, like, pesticides and how certain crops are resistant to certain pesticides, and different companies, it seems like, have different kind of proprietary things regarding that. I don't totally get it, but it seems like that's a big part of why people are concerned about these mergers. Is that something that you can explain?
Well, the bottom line is that farming today is really a high-tech venture. There are really complex actual crops and seeds that were born from a ton of research, and that can just be conventionally bred, you know, where you take one plant that exhibits a particular trait and another plant that exhibits a different trait, but that you want the both of them, say, one that grows to the correct height. So maybe it's short, so it doesn't fall over in the field. So you want that if you're a farmer, and you take that and you breed it with one that is particularly hardy in colder temperatures. And so if you want to, if you're in the Dakotas and you want to plant corn, you want it to be the right height and you want it to be able to survive, you know, the colder temperatures than are in Texas. And researchers would spend years kind of breeding that until they can have a new plant, a new kind of corn that will express that trait. So that takes a lot of time and effort and energy and money just to do that. And then, you know, you touched on it. There are GMOs, obviously, there's genetically engineered crops that have specific genes kind of inserted into them to express other different traits to make those plants more, you know, hardy or make them resistant, as you said, to certain pesticides. So a farmer can, you know, use those pesticides to kill the weeds and it won't kill the corn, for instance, or kill the soybeans. So like I said, this is high technology and high technology costs money. So you have, you know, this huge demand from the world for all kinds of different food. And the crops that go into producing that food. So there's a lot of money there. And then because we've wanted this stable crop, we wanted really high-tech kinds of plants that are going to produce the same thing year after year after year, there's been a lot of money and effort to go into that. And that requires these big companies with large research budgets.
We just heard how hard the unpredictability of farming can be on a family farmer, that fellow in Nebraska who is really struggling to be able to afford the property taxes, which stay the same year after year, even though his crop yield might be different. So is this kind of the industry's answer to that?
Yeah, I think any farmer will tell you that it is a risky business even today, but it was much more so 100 years ago or 60 years ago. And the research and time and energy that has gone into that has really been, can we make a more stable crop so we know about what we can get year after year, so that businesses can depend on it, so the global food supply can depend on it, and so farmers can hopefully depend on it.
U.S. investors just approved the merger of Monsanto and Bayer, and the announcement of Jeff Sessions as Trump's appointment for attorney general is certainly making a lot of people think the deal is pretty likely to go through. But what hurdles does it still need to clear?
Well, you talked about how these are multinational companies, and really the food system today is a global system. So it's not just the U.S. antitrust regulators that need to sign off on this, although that is a very big piece of it. But there are huge markets that could also scuttle this deal if their antitrust regulators don't sign off on it. So Europe, Brazil come to mind immediately. These companies want to be able to operate in all of those markets. And so if they can't, that would shoot the deal down. So I think there's that. And then as we talked about earlier, there are a number of kind of mergers and buyouts on the table in this industry. So, you know, it's not just Bayer buying Monsanto. It's also Dow merging with DuPont. It's also a Chinese chemical company buying Syngenta. So it's globally. And I think that all the regulators are going to be looking at that global landscape when they look to approve or disapprove of these mergers and buyouts.
What, I mean, we've talked about that predictability can be kind of an upside to what these big companies do, but what are the downsides? Or maybe to put it a different way, what do critics of these deals fear? What are they worried about?
Well, I think this has become a very hot button issue when it comes to kind of corporate control or corporate influence in agriculture. So I think there are critics. Well, I guess the bottom line I would say is that there are some critics who maybe go off on a limb and aren't as fact-based as a journalist might like. But I think there are some legitimate criticisms, certainly a few that come to mind. One would be corporate control. You know, anytime that you do have the winnowing of choices for farmers, you know, you're going to depress markets. You have these huge multinational corporations with giant budgets that have the ability to kind of overtly influence policy. These corporations, for instance, have massive lobbying budgets and have presence in Washington and other global capitals. So I think that's an important point. But they're also going to have the ability, you know, to help set prices. When you only have three or four firms that virtually every farmer is going to have to deal with, it's much easier, even if it's not done in a criminal way, it's much easier to set prices at a low level because farmers don't have, you know, another competitor to turn. So I think corporate control is one. I think another is environmental concerns. You know, these companies make a lot of their money selling kind of a suite of products that are basically chemicals, fertilizers, and seeds, and they all go together. And so there's a lot of research. There's a lot of debate on whether there are more or less chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides, those kinds of things that have been used with the advent of GMOs. And I think the science is still trying to figure that out. I think it's about kind of how you measure it and in what way. But it certainly has ushered in a new era of farming where we're plowing up a lot more land. That has environmental consequences. Where you're using different amounts of water, that has environmental consequences. So I think corporate control and environmental consequences are two things that, you know, bear further scrutiny.
The term big ag gets thrown around in conversations like this. And I want to be really specific about what people mean when they use that term, because terms like it, like big pharma, or I've even recently heard big law, can sound a little like the boogeyman, as in scary but undefined.
Yeah, and I think that's really the tough kind of, that's a really tough question, because I think the term big ag, such as it is, it really does mean different things to different people. So it is very hard to define. Just as we'll get into later, the term family farm kind of has come across its own meaning. So, you know, I think big ag is about corporate control and power in our food system. And I think you can look at it, I guess it's important to note that there are very few corporations that actually do farming. There are very few farms that are owned by corporations. You know, even whether it's crops or meat or anything, it's very few. But there are big multinational corporations that exert enormous amounts of influence on our food system. And I think that is kind of what that term big ag is trying to get at.
So would you say that the family farm is the opposite of big ag, or is the relationship more complex than that?
Oh, absolutely more complex. I think some folks who use the term big ag, you know, would have somebody like a Larry Tegeler in mind, who farms 1,000 to 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans every single year in Nebraska. But as we heard, I mean, it's Larry and his son are the farmers there. So why is that not a family farm? And I think that is a complicating factor when you talk about family farms, when you talk about big ag. I think that's a good thing, but it's both of those terms are pretty tough to define for that reason.
Okay, Jeremy, stay with me. I want to get back to you, but this seems like a good time to start hearing from some farmers, okay?
Sure.
Frank Geringer is with us from an orchard and berry farm in Edgerton, Kansas. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
How many acres do you farm?
We farm about between 800 and 900 acres of conventional row crop. We also do probably 30 to 40 acre of specialty produce.
Okay, so define those two things for us. We've got conventional row crop and specialty produce. Conventional row crop being?
Corn and soybeans, mainly.
And your specialty produce is?
Berries, tree fruit. We've raised some sweet corn. We have high tunnels. We've kind of diversified into more of the direct marketing specialty crops where we're at.
How did you get into farming? Are you coming from a family of farmers?
No, it's actually, we're kind of unusual in the fact that I grew up in town. I didn't marry a farmer. I didn't inherit a farm. So it was kind of a struggle. We started in the late 70s with some hogs. At the time, they were called the mortgage lifters. if you didn't mind the smell and were willing to work hard, they consistently made money. And then as we've continued to increase our size, we started farming a little more. Hogs were no longer profitable, so we decided to get into the specialty fruit.
Do you think that coming to it without the background necessarily maybe has allowed you to be kind of flexible and nimble, maybe not as attached to some ingrained idea about what farming is?
I think it had advantages in that respect. The fact that I didn't have a father or grandfather farming ahead of me, I see some operations that are very well entrenched and don't want to seem to look outside the box. You know, Grandpa did this, Dad did this. If Junior comes home, he feels like that he doesn't have any degree of authority, so he just kind of does it the way Dad and Grandpa, and you just see generations progress. We did a little more thinking outside the box, and, you know, if you find something that's not working for you, the first thing you do is, if you find yourself in the hole, is you quit digging. So when hogs were no longer profitable, rather than continuing down that stream, we looked for alternatives, and the fruit and vegetables where we're at were a good choice for us.
Okay, so this is We've been talking to Frank Gehringer. Now I want to hear from Ashley McCarty. She's with us, too. She's with us remotely, I should say, from her farm out in Missouri. Ashley, good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell me about your operation.
So my husband and I and three young boys raise cattle on pasture in northeast Missouri. We have about 90 mama cows. We breed and raise those calves until they're about 5 months old and then typically sell them locally, and they head to maybe wheat pastures out towards Frank and Larry, or are backgrounded here in the state, which means they are raised for a few hundred more pounds on grass. And my family has this, I am the fifth generation.
Wait,
here.
IMD, what's that?
I am the fifth generation.
Oh, I am, sorry.
Yes, pardon me. Yes, on this farm. I don't have a father that came from the farm or was on the farm, so I really followed in the footsteps of my grandparents, who had really struggled to make it back to our century family farm. So it's been in the family over a century. It was the core of the farm, that century family farm, is 160 acres, which is about enough grass to keep 30 to 35 cows year round. So my husband and I have expanded. We have approximately 500 acres of grass and timber that we graze.
So how, in just sort of the short version, how is what you do different from what your folks did? Now, or excuse me, not your folks, your grandparents.
Yes. So in one way that it's different, and one way that we've expanded, is I don't know that for the generations before me that I know, that 160 acres really didn't provide a full living for an entire family. It still didn't, but that's our goal in mind. So that's why we have purchased some more neighboring ground. That's why we're renting some grass, because there's just an efficiency that comes with more cattle. You've got to have the same infrastructure. You've got to have handling equipment and trailers and trucks. And so we're trying to get to a point where it becomes economically efficient. And we have that goal in mind. My husband and I both went to the University of Missouri. I got an animal science degree. He pursued a general agriculture degree. So that's one way, is that we brought education and a scientific perspective back a little differently. He didn't have a family that had grown up farming either. And so we were scrambling to, you know, kind of put all the pieces together. The other way is we do adopt technology that wasn't available to my grandpa. So for instance, we artificially inseminate our cattle sometimes, some of them anyway, so that we can bring genetics and the quality of genetics that we couldn't otherwise buy. We can get a bull that's sold for $60,000 at a sale somewhere. We can get a piece of him and bring him home and see the benefits in our cattle, in their growth and their performance, that my grandpa wouldn't have had the opportunity to be able to do.
Okay, so this is Ashley McCarty. She's talking with us from, is it Novinger, Missouri?
Yeah, Kirksville is the region. Yep.
All right. We're going to hear more from her later. Let's meet Adam Baldwin. Adam, are you there?
Yeah, great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Adam is with us from his farm in McPherson, Kansas, an hour north of Wichita. And Adam, how many acres do you farm?
Well, myself personally, I have about 1,400 acres, but I farm with my father in kind of what is described as two separate overlapping entities. So he has around 2,000, I have 1,400, so put us together around 3,400.
So just a small operation.
I would say in our area, it would be a upper mid-sized.
Yeah.
We're definitely,
I was being sarcastic.
But I mean, our family farm story sounds a lot like Frank's, actually. My dad's originally from southeast Kansas, married my mom. They went to college with both of them. My mom had no intention of marrying a farmer. My dad had no intention to farm. They were offered the opportunity to come back and partner with my grandpa, my mom's father. The partnership quickly turned into a lifetime hired man, they realized, and he wasn't, and it was a little bit like what had Frank said, that it was, you were going to have to fall in line with the father. And so my dad wasn't happy. He was going to move back to southeast Kansas. And to keep my mom there, my mom's father, my grandpa, turned over 80 acres, a grain bin business to sell grain bins. And then My dad got into hog business, and he's built our operation up from that.
How old are you?
37, so middle age, but in terms of farming, I'd still consider myself young.
Do you think that what you do is separate from quote-unquote big ag, or is it part of that picture in your mind?
I think big ag's tough to explain. I'm sure there'd be a lot of your listeners that would view us as big ag. We're using large-scale equipment. We're using technology as much as we can in terms of if we can find technology that's going to have a profitable return on investment that we can afford, we're going to use that. And I think a lot of times that's going to make us better stewards of the land, whether we're varying the rate of fertilizers we apply across the field based on the farm's productivity or current available nutrients in the soil, maybe varying the rate that we plant seeds. We have our sprayers. One will drive themselves when we're applying crop protection products, but then they will automatically turn off so we don't overlap any more than possible. So we're doing the best we can to manage it. And in full disclosure, I'm 1,400 acres isn't a full employment, so I sell seed on the side too. So I am part of the big ag system.
Okay, Adam, Ashley, and Frank all run what could be called family farms in Kansas and Missouri. And in some ways, they couldn't be more different. In some ways, they have a lot in common. We'll get to know them better when KCUR's Central Standard returns. You can tell us how your family's relationship to farming has changed or maybe hasn't changed after the break. 816-235-2888. We're back. Today's conversation on KCUR's Central Standard is about big ag and the family farm. We want to know how family farms are responding to industry pressures. Are family farms and big ag on opposite ends of some spectrum, or is the dynamic more, if you can't beat them, join them, that kind of thing? I'm Gina Kaufman, here with three family farmers. Frank Geringer runs what we might call a smallish to medium-sized operation in Edgerton, Kansas. And Adam Baldwin, who I'm going to try very hard not to call Alec Baldwin at any point during this show, has a pretty big farm an hour north of Wichita. We're also talking with Ashley McCarty. She runs a small farm near Kirksville, Missouri. You can call 816-235-2888 to join our conversation. And Ashley, paint the picture of life on your farm for me in a little more detail. When you wake up in the morning, what's the first thing you do?
The first thing that I do is attend to the three young boys that we are raising to be able to work and know the farm as well. And so it is very much a family affair here. In fact, our three kids are, well, one is two, one is six, one is nine. But our boys are homeschooling right now, in part because we have this investment of time and energy and resources into a farm and felt that they weren't really getting to participate. And so, you know, this time of year is a time that requires the most labor, as you might imagine, in the cold weather. And so our
why is that? Chores, actually, that isn't what I would imagine.
Okay. It is because I call our farm kind of a solar panel. Picture those pastures that you drive by as big solar panels, and the harvesters that we use are cattle. And so when the grass is green and growing, they are very self-sufficient in large part. We make sure their vitamin and mineral needs are taken care of, that there's always abundant water, and that we rotate them when grass is growing to pastures with fresh grass so that our pastures can recover and grow back. We rotate them through pastures. But this time of year, once the forage has quit growing, it is the harvested grass that we put into big round bales this summer that we haul to them individually. And so cold weather this last week, as cold weather hit, their metabolic needs go up. They're staying warm through the digestion of the forage that they're eating. So we fed hay twice a day the last several days just to try to keep up with their increased energy needs to stay warm and comfortable, to roll out hay so that they're not laying in the snow, really. They've got somewhere to bed down that's nice and warm. And so that sometimes involves a tractor. and going and rolling out hay or setting it in a ring for them to eat. That sometimes in better weather involves a truck with a bale bed that we can fit all the kids into so that they can come along. It also involves, this last week was several frozen waterers that the weather just got ahead of us. It was cold and involved many hours of laying in icy, slushy water, trying to defrost those waters. Many of our waters come out of farm ponds that have been built for that purpose. Some are off county water. So those are our needs this time of year. The other thing, in an hour, the vet will be here. The veterinarian that works with us closely on all of our animal health and reproductive needs, really. And we had a bull. It is, for us, breeding season. So bulls are out with the cows. And it's been icy. He has apparently twisted his knee. And so we will be trying to figure out how to attend to the bull that has a sprained or a twisted knee and how to keep him comfortable and get him back out to work as soon as possible.
Just, I want to get back to your story, but we've been talking about, you know, like family farms and family farmers. And with cattle, generally people talk about ranching. Does it bother you for me to call you a farmer?
Not at all. We probably have a style that is more ranching. We use horses here. We've got 10 horses that we do our cow work generally off of horseback. But I'll say that's probably unique in most of Missouri. And we certainly would be called farmers across the state. We would be a little unique in our ranching perspective.
So talk to me about, we talked about how your day starts with you tending to your sons as part of this picture of homeschooling and farming as an investment really in that farm, both present and future. But talk to me a little bit more about how your day ends.
Yes.
Does it end?
Yes. So often it starts in the dark and ends in the dark with cattle work. I should say, in between those times, both my husband and I have a job, which is very much necessitated by the economics of our scale of farm. So even at 500 acres of grass and almost 100 mama cows, there certainly hasn't been enough that one of us has felt like we should give up our paying jobs with health insurance. And so mine is only part-time. Therefore, I can be home with boys and homeschool and, you know, meet the vet as he comes here in an hour. His is a full-time job working for the utility company in town, and then comes home and starts the second part of his second full-time job as he gets home and on the weekends. And so we never have to wonder around here what we're going to do with the weekend. It's booked for as long as we can picture. Anytime you look up, there's always work to be done. There are fences to be built. There's brush to be cut. There are pastures to be managed. There's no shortage ever of work here, but we absolutely love that. We have chosen that. Though it's not penciled out after all expenses in the black, really, all but 1 year for the 7 years we've been back home from college and career. We know that it will be, and we're looking towards increasing efficiency and productivity all the time to build that business.
Well, you talked about that you love it and you chose it. It mm-hmm. sounds both beautiful and punishingly difficult. And I wonder why you chose it. What was it that you hoped being a rancher or farmer would do for you in your life?
Your description is accurate. My friends from town say, you guys have got to be the hardest working people we know. We are not more hardworking than other folks on the farm. We just may be the farm family they're best connected with. We chose it really. There is something so refreshing and empowering about being that connected with nature, getting to see that really the fruit, the literal fruit of your labor, as I'm sure our other guests can remark, that is just so encouraging. And so, and it just started for both my husband and I at a very young age, getting to follow around my hardworking grandfather and instilled a love. I love animals. Absolutely just enjoy every day and can't picture a better way to teach our kids to be hardworking, respectful, ethical individuals than them tending to the care of animals and the land, which we take really seriously every day, because not only is it the right thing to do, it is our business. And so being efficient and being productive and being good stewards ties into everything that we do.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that, because this is the second time that stewardship of the land has come into play. We'll pick up on that shortly, but you've answered this a little bit. How do you stay in business? You've mentioned that you and your husband both have jobs in addition to your farming jobs. And you've also mentioned an investment in education and in technology. But are there challenges to staying in business? You are running a pretty small farm, and if there weren't, you probably wouldn't have second jobs.
Mm-hmm. There certainly are challenges. And while I should say, compared to the acres that our other guests in Kansas have, the average size of a herd of cows in Missouri is 30, it's in the 30s, 38, I think. And so while we don't have very many cows and not enough to keep somebody home, we have more than the average. So when I look at data, U.S. Department of Agriculture census data, about half of farmers in the state of Missouri do not consider farming their primary occupation. So we fall right in with that average across the state. And there are certainly challenges. So we're just coming off record highs in the cattle industry, which was the year that we have seen our bottom line be in the black rather than the red. But we have also been keeping half of our herd every year, or close to, of all of our heifers, because we've been growing. When we moved home 9 years ago, my father-in-law gave us his 20 young cows, knowing, kind of like I think Frank said or Adam said, that it would keep us rooted close to home. And so we've been retaining heifers to grow that herd since that point. When we sold calves last year, our check was down 40% just because of the volatility in the markets. And so that's certainly something that makes us appreciate the jobs that we have that draw a paycheck and that can be predicted from month to month and help balance out that extreme volatility as we continue to build our asset base, build our net worth, essentially, and build. We inherited infrastructure from my great-grandpa's fences, for instance. So the work around here is not only building fence, it's tearing out a two-generation-old fence to replace it with new infrastructure. And I think that's pretty common across the landscape.
Okay, well, we're going to turn to another direction now. Thank you, Ashley. Adam Baldwin, your farm north of Wichita is very different from Ashley's, at least in scale. I mean, by comparison, it's huge. Is it different in other ways, too?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, grain farming and livestock, they're definitely different. Livestock, you have a little bit more opportunity to vary your herd size. The problem with grain farming is, especially at times these that are the grain prices are below cost of production. You know, we rent most of our ground. I know there was one of your pieces earlier. It was a farmer talking about owning most of it in Nebraska, and ours is we have landlords all over the country, and they want their ground farmed. And
why so is that? Wait, so people all over the country own land in Kansas?
Well, yeah. So we have a landlady in Seattle, and I mean her family homesteaded the ground when westward expansion happened, and she has a tie to that ground. There's a tree on that farm where the sod house used to be. That tree has to stay there. It's in the middle of the field. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but it has an emotional tie, and so you know we respect that. Obviously,
those are the rules.
Yeah, and I have a landlady in Detroit. I have a landlord that's a Kansas state senator who owns ground because he grew up on a farm and he likes the idea of owning ground. I think people that grow up in agriculture, there's something that they're really tied to it and they want to be a part of it.
What made you want to be a farmer? I mean, I know you have this family background, but you probably had other choices.
Yeah, I went to K-State in 1998 with absolutely no intention to farm. I thought it was boring. I didn't like it. It was more like I was forced labor a little bit in terms of working for my dad.
Just then, growing up in a family business.
No. I think that's a lot of times people have to realize that a family farm and a family store on Main Street or a plumbing operation, they're all the same dynamics. But anyways, I was in an agricultural fraternity at K-State, and I had all these friends that really wanted to go home and farm, and their operations that their fathers had wasn't going to allow it. And the one thing my dad always told me is, if you want to come home, we can make it work.
And why was it such a trend that the model of farming for all of these other people wasn't going to allow them to come back and take over?
Well, I don't even know if it's a trend. I think it's a mentality. So my dad's father, he told all his kids, do not come back and farm, because like it's mentioned, the life is hard. And you know, there's a gap, in farmers, and probably that upper 40s to 50s where the guys didn't come back because it was the 1980s and farms were going bankrupt and there wasn't profitability. And my dad survived that barely. He said it's mostly because he had bad credit and he couldn't get a loan, so he couldn't get hung out on high interest rates. but you know, and he worked and built it, and I think that was just his mentality. You know, I have friends that when they say, "Well, I'll go get a job and then I'll work for a few years and come back," and I knew for me, if you got used to a regular paycheck that paid good, it was going to be pretty tough to come back and start at the bottom rung. And so I just went home and decided I was going to try to make a go of it. And I kind of gave myself a few years. And if I wasn't going to have progress, then I would go find a different job. But luckily, I've had, as other neighboring farmers have retired, they've directed ground my way or rented ground that they own to me. And so then I've able to have a decent operation now.
Talk to me about your business model.
I guess the business model is the same as any commodity product, is to produce, to be a low cost producer. I mean, there's really no way around that. You know, we try to maximize an acre of ground is basically our factory, and we have to maximize what that acre can do.
So how do you do that?
Well, you're going to plant your best genetics. I think that's one thing when you go back to they talked earlier about people concerned about the large seed companies. Well, there hasn't been one farmer that's ever had a gun pointed to his head and said, you're going to plant Pioneer. Well, no, the farmer's going to plant the seed that is best suited for their conditions. And it may be a Monsanto brand. It may be a DuPont Pioneer brand. It'll be whatever they feel is the best fit. But then you're going to fertilize to what that plant needs. I mean, you don't want to over-fertilize. You don't want to under-fertilize. And you can do everything you can to set that crop up, and next thing you know, you have a windstorm that wipes out all your corn, or a hailstorm that takes out all your wheat. So, you know, that is the risk, but it's, you know, it's part of the excitement, I guess, too, is just seeing if you can get the work done.
So when we talk about like mergers and the consolidation of multinational ag companies, how does all of that affect you? Maybe other farmers you know of about the same scale?
I would say people don't necessarily like it. There is the concern of, you know, decreased choices. But on the flip side, I would say, especially given current commodity prices, I think there's an opportunity for smaller companies. I think guys are starting to look around and they're willing to maybe not purchase the latest seed with the most technology or the latest germplasm and save a little
money. I don't
even
know what a germplasm is, but I'm going to let it go.
The genetic material. That's when you're buying seed, that's what we're buying. We're buying the genetic potential of that seed. However that's been bred, that's what we're buying. We're buying that opportunity to use that.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll get some response to this discussion from Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld, and we'll hear more from our medium-sized farm guy from Edgerton. If farming is like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, maybe we can call his farm just right. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be back in a minute. Hello again. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're hearing all about different versions of the family farm in Kansas and Missouri. The family farm is this thing where we have a picture in our heads a lot of times with a dairy cow in front of a red barn and chickens wandering around. That is not necessarily what they look like, and in fact, they can look a lot of different ways, as we're discovering. I want to turn to Jeremy Bernfeld. He's the editor of Harvest Public Media. And Jeremy, what are you hearing as sort of recurring themes that you would like to maybe draw our attention to, looking at agriculture writ large?
Well, I think you hit on it, how just the vast diversity among farmers today. There are so many things that tie them together and so many things that I think separate today's kind of modern farmer. The thing that the backdrop here is that, depending on what kind of numbers you use, between, say, 90 and 98% of farms in the U.S. are classified as family farms. So obviously that's going to mean there's a huge kind of wide array of the kinds of farmers that we have today. The other thing I might touch on is that there's a consumer connection here. We talked earlier about big ag. Certainly buying local or family farms, the story behind your food is very prominent today in our food system. And I think there's a bit of a disconnection, especially among folks who like to kind of use big ag as a negative term, that they play a role in this. I mean, all the farmers here are certainly dedicated to making a living. And that means that they're going to grow, they're going to raise the kind of crops and livestock that people want to buy. And so we have this massive, for instance, we have a massive taste for meat in this country and globally that's rising. So what that means is we have this whole system set up to produce as much meat as possible that's as cheap as possible, because we all want to buy cheap meat. And so that's kind of, that consumer demand is driving that whole thing. And so I think it's important for people to know when they go to the grocery store that the way that they shop, is eventually going to filter down to the farm.
Jeremy, something that has come up a couple of times is this idea of stewardship of the land, which I think sort of in popular discourse, we can think about environmental concerns as being sort of on one side and farming and the demands of farmers on the other. And yet we hear farmers returning to this idea, stewardship of the land. Can you talk to me about how that fits into this picture?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a fascinating kind of part of this discussion. I think to a person, every farmer that I speak to, that our reporters at Harvest Public Media speak to, every farmer would say, we absolutely care deeply about the land. And it makes sense, you know, aside from any kind of, feeling that they have, it's their product. They want to make sure that to run their business, their land has to be as healthy as it can possibly be.
And who is closer to the land than a farmer? I mean, those of us sitting in offices, you know.
Well, exactly. I think that's exactly what any farmer would say to you. So I think it's important to also look at macro issues. You know, you look in Des Moines, the city of Des Moines is having a lot of problems keeping its drinking water clean enough, in large part because of farms upstream, that some of the chemicals that they use have kind of leached off the farms and into rivers that supply the water there. So it's not that it's not that these farmers are in any way, you know, evil and trying to make problems. It's that they're working within a system where they're trying to, you know, make their business work for them as best that they can, and comply with all of the relevant, you know, environmental regulations and laws. Now, when you combine all of those tiny little bits together, it can create a problem downstream. And so they're working through that. But it's important to know that, again, even in that situation, it's not that any farmer up there is thinking like, what can I dump into the river here? And with reckless disregard for my fellow people, those farmers there absolutely want their land to be as healthy as it can possibly be, just in fact, so they can make a living.
One last question for you, Jeremy. I've observed in this conversation that most of our farmers sound a lot like economists in the language that they use. And we've heard that a lot of our farmers that we're talking to have gotten higher educations to do what they do. I mean, very specifically, you know, or tailored educations. And I think that goes, that's not how a lot of people imagine that farmers learn to do what they do. We're hearing about the highly technological aspect of farming these days. I mean, how is that changing the economic picture? I would imagine an education, you have maybe loans to pay off, but also, you know, you're bringing this asset to the picture.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. Farming, as we've said, encompasses a lot of technology and a lot of different, you know, ways of thinking, whether it's certainly understanding everything from, say, biology to economics to global trade to politics to, you know, working with your local environmental regulator, all of those different things. That's just part and parcel to being a farmer today. And so it does require, you know, a lot of training, a lot of knowledge, a lot of education to do this the right way. The profit margins are so thin that, you know, any small slip up is going to mean a great deal. And so you have to really be prepared to do it the right way. And then, you know, in terms of how that impacts the future? Well, I think right now, for instance, we have a reporter who's in Missouri, Christopher Husted, who's working on a story about young farmers who are having difficulty getting into farming because A, land prices and the other input prices are so high, but also because of student debt. So I think having land prices and inputs, you know, buying a really expensive tractor, for instance, being so high, that's been a consistent story over the last, say, two decades. But yeah, I'm not going to say you have to have an agriculture degree to be a farmer today, but it certainly helps a lot. And I think just like any other industry, the cost of higher education is so high, it's becoming a barrier to some people who want to be farmers.
Jeremy Bernfeld, Harvest Public Media, thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Great to be there. Thanks.
And so now I'm going to turn to Frank Geringer. He has a peach and berry orchard as in addition to the row crops, the conventional crops that he farms out in Edgerton. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
So you remind us again of this sort of scale and scope of what you do.
Well, besides our row crop, we have a small cow herd, which we've kept. We have about 10 acres of peaches. We do 3 acres of U-pick strawberries. We do approximately 2 acres of blackberries. We have some blueberries planted that we'll be harvesting this year, and we're in the process of getting started with some trellised apples. We do a pumpkin patch in the fall, so we're pretty diversified.
You started your farm from scratch. You didn't inherit a farm, as you've said. We just heard about sort of barriers to entry. You got started in the 70s, so things have changed, but talk to us about going into farming from scratch.
I think getting started in farming's always been hard. Maybe today we have a few more zeros behind the price tags on things, but it's never been easy. I graduated in 77. I bought my first farm in 1979. For those of you that aren't familiar with that, the 80s followed. I purchased a farm that was probably worth about...
That's what comes after 79.
Right. The 80s, double-digit interest rates. Bought a farm in 79. It was worth probably one-third of what I paid for it 5 years later. And at that time, nobody had fixed-rate loans. So we started out with approximately a 7% loan. And I don't remember actually how high it did get, but I'm sure it was at least 15 at one time. So it was very painful. I lived at home. I guess I was just too poor to realize that I was poor, but we worked hard and we managed to survive the 80s. But
how do you stay afloat now? I mean, how does your business model work, and do you feel confident in it at this stage?
Yeah, I'm mid 50s, so my wife and I are comfortable. We've got our house and farm paid for. We've recently bought some additional ground. Our son has came into the operation, so that's kind of made for an interesting process getting him incorporated into the farm picture.
What about the U-pick aspect of it? I mean, is agritourism a big part of how you're staying alive?
I wouldn't say it's a reason we stayed alive. I did conventional agriculture for 30 plus years. It's only been in the last 4 or 5 that we've really gotten into agritourism. We're in kind of a unique situation, I guess not unique, but we're located fairly close to metropolitan area. We're extremely rural. We don't even have rural water yet where we're at. But within a 30-minute drive, I can be in Overland Park. A few more minutes, I can be in downtown Kansas City.
In our studios.
Yes, your studios, exactly. So rather than trying to compete to outrent the neighbor on more ground, which we're continuing to see development and urban encroachment, we looked at ways that we could increase the value of what we were raising on the property that we did have. So that's kind of why we turned to the UPIC and the agritourism.
Oh, man. Well, our time is up, but keep talking to us out there if you have something to contribute to this conversation. We want to keep trying to understand the big picture with family farming and agriculture in Kansas and Missouri. So keep it going on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, or email us if you think there's something we missed and that we need to talk about. centralstandard@kcur.org. Frank Gehringer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ashley McCarty, best of luck to you in Kirksville.
Thank you very much, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you. And Adam Baldwin, enjoy the rest of the day out there in McPherson, Kansas.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You can listen back to this show at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, Sally Neville has worked for the Kansas City Care Clinic since the early 90s, near the beginning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. She's been instrumental in Kansas City's response to that crisis. Now she's leaving the organization. We'll hear her story as she goes. That's tomorrow. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Andrea Tudhope, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.